Don't touch that dial. You're tuned in to the Dread Podcast Network.
You are now listening to Postmortem with Mick Garris, where the most influential voices in horror cinema will spill their guts to the renowned horror director, writer, and producer. Now, here's your host, Mick Garris.
From Nice Guy Productions' world headquarters overlooking the glamorous San Fernando Valley, I'm Mick Garris, and this is Postmortem. One of the things we like to do here on the podcast is salute the anniversaries of landmark genre films, up until now with the filmmakers who made them. Well, today we're saluting one of the most influential films of my life on a key birthday. It's not Psycho, it's not The Evil Dead, it's not An American Werewolf in London, and no, it's not The Exorcist. Today, we are here to pay homage to the 75th birthday of Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein. This was one of my favorite movies ever and remains the same. It's funny, it's scary, and it's beautifully made. It takes its monsters seriously and finds its laughs through Bud and Lou. Anyway, obviously none of the people who made the film are still with us 75 years later, but we've brought on board one of our favorite guests to share our celebration. Dana Gould is a comedian, writer, actor, and big fan of fantastic films. So who better to join us in celebration of this milestone in horror comedy? Let us sing the praises of Laughs and Monsters and the stake through the heart of Universal's classic creatures. Dana, welcome back to the slab.
So you're telling me you saw Dracula?
Oh no, that's Bud. See, I get it wrong. That was Bud.
You're telling me you saw Dracula.
And it's Dracula.
Dracula.
You're telling me you saw Dracula.
What's the first time you saw it?
Gosh, I saw this as, you know, a kid. Growing up in Massachusetts, I was a monster kid like everybody listening and everybody in this room probably. And it was the monster movie that was on that week.
Right.
You know?
Right. The million-dollar movie.
Yeah. And Creature Double Feature we had in Massachusetts. And to me, there was no difference between that and The Wolfman or Frankenstein. Like, oh, this is the one that is this week. And it was comedy, but it didn't bother
another monster movie.
Yeah, just another monster movie.
Yeah.
And it does have, now that I'm older and, you know, have written both genres and tried to do a horror comedy on my own. There are many ways to do horror comedy, and more ways to do it incorrectly.
Yes.
The monsters, by and large, play it straight, and they don't realize that they're in a comedy.
Right.
And Bud and Lou are Bud and Lou. And this came at a time in their career when they were in the doldrums.
Yeah.
The bloom was off the Abbott and Costello rose when this feature came along. Universal was really looking at two of their properties.
Franchises that were falling apart.
Yes, yeah. Perfect. Yes, that's exactly right. And they said, maybe they'll goose each other if we put them together. And it absolutely reinvigorated Abbott and Costello's career. And Lou did not want to make it.
Really?
And yeah.
It's amazing because it is as well made as any of the Universal horror movies. And yet it's from a director who did tons of Abbott and Costello movies. He was kind of the hired hand director on the lot at Universal, who would do all kinds of things.
Right.
Now, Buck Privates in 1941 was Universal's biggest grossing movie of that year, starring Abbott and Costello. Here we are only 7 years later, and their career is kind of hanging in the balance.
And one of the other big hits that year was The Wolfman. So those two franchises did sort of,
they bisected.
Yeah, right? and they sort of peaked together.
Right.
And sort of,
The Wolfman was kind of the tail end of the first strain of Universal horror movies.
You can hear women getting turned on as we talk about this.
no doubt, yes.
Two dudes talking about Abbott Costello and The Wolfman. Really,
yeah. Next, it'll be The Three Stooges.
Welcome back to Fort Panty Drop. But it is true. You know, those were they got Universal through the 40s.
Yeah.
And they had the monster, you know, the Wolfman sort of kicked off the second phase of the horror cycle, and
then it became monster parties with Frankenstein meets the Wolfman, yeah, and then Ghost of, and
yeah, and the mummy cycle,
yeah,
the world's slowest walking monster,
yeah,
stroll for your life, it's, yeah, the mummy,
yeah, here comes the mummy, we better walk a little faster.
Yes, my God, walk for your life, it's the mummy. But great movies, and they're all like, yeah, 45 minutes long, they're, yeah, easy to watch.
Really quick. Bite size.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, and then when they put them together, what I find interesting about having a Costello meet Frankenstein is I showed it to my girls, my daughters, when they were, you know, like 8 and 9, and they laughed at it. And they, you know, you can't get modern kids to watch a black and white movie. And they watched it and they laughed, which I thought was really amazing. And they laughed at Lou Costello.
Well, last year, the Cinematheque asked me to choose a black and white movie to host. And I chose Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein. And it was sold out, ages from my age to your age to children.
It's very beloved.
And all the way through. And it played like gangbusters. Mm-hmm. Sold out crowd, laughing, jumping, screaming, all this. It was just magic.
Yeah. And it is funny because Lou Costello on screen is so affable and lovable, and off screen was so not.
Really? Oh, I did not know this, yeah, about him.
He was a real piece of work.
Oh dear.
Yeah. And but you know, Bud Abbott was much more easygoing and
just kind of removed is what I heard about,
yeah,
him.
Well, yeah. I think that was the only way to deal with Lou, really, who was a very difficult, I mean, he had big tragedies in his life, but yeah. You know, difficult personality, bully, narcissist. There is on YouTube outtakes of this movie. I'm sure you, I don't know if you've seen them or not.
I haven't seen them, no.
And he is clearly saying some stuff to the female actress that today you could not say on a movie set.
And you shouldn't have then.
Yeah, you shouldn't have then. Yeah, and it's right there on film. You're like, whoa.
Not funny, cool. Funny little playful, affable Lou Costello.
Yeah, yeah. And she's just like, you can see her, even though it's 1949, she's like, it's really, yeah.
It's amazing. This is a movie that 75 years later is still popular.
Mm-hmm.
And it's maintained that. I mean, you are a real Hollywood scholar, not just of the genre, but of your Dr. Z spoofs that just go into all of these movie, yeah, stars, TV stars, everything like that.
It's a great repository for my mental landfill of useless knowledge.
Yes. But it's so funny. But it wouldn't be so funny if it weren't so knowing and so accurate about, you know, all of these,
right, B-list and affectionate actors and affectionate of this, yeah, stuff. Yeah, yeah,
yeah,
for sure.
It's loving, and it talks about Schwabs and all of the, you know.
Oh, you do read it. You do.
Oh, absolutely. Well, I used to live around the corner from Schwabs.
The one on Crescent Heights.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Back in my younger days.
Right. And then it was the Virgin Megastore, and now it's a bunch of.
Now it's a movie theater and other things.
Yeah, it's a, yeah, movie theater that nobody goes to.
Yeah. But, you know, this, what was it like when you made the move to Hollywood, this fabled Oz of your passion?
It was great. I mean, I wanted to live in L.A. since I grew up in Massachusetts in a really small little mill town on Cemetery Street.
Ooh.
I lived at the intersection of Cemetery and Hope Streets. And
now there's an ironic corner.
I know. I have the, and by the way, I have the sign intersection. I have the photo. I'm not making it up. My childhood address was 9 Cemetery Street and in Hopedale, Massachusetts, a very small town.
Wow.
Home to me and Joe Perry, the lead guitarist for Aerosmith.
Yeah.
And his mother was the gym teacher at our high school.
Wow.
And long story longer, I grew up loving that stuff. But as a kid, I watched The Brady Bunch and Adam 12 and Emergency and Dragnet. And I was like, no, that I want to live there. It just looked like a great place. It was bright. It was sunny. It was open. I mean, my family was as far from The Brady Bunch as you could get. So that's what I aspired to. So I just wanted to live where they were and be like them. I lived in San Francisco for 2 years and then I moved to Los Angeles. And I loved it from day one and still do. I live down behind my first apartment was down by the Peterson Auto Museum.
Oh, wow. Down in Wilshire.
Yeah. And my girlfriend at the time worked at the May Company, which is now the Academy Museum. Yeah. But at the time it was still a May Company.
Yeah, beautiful building, kind of an Art Deco gold architecture from the era.
They really wanted to demo that building because it was over 20 years old. So in LA, they have an alarm that goes off when a building is 20 years old. Plow it down and put up a cube.
Oh, no, there goes my house.
This could be a Jersey Mike's. Let's go. So it was great from day one. And I grew up watching all that stuff. And, like, I remember, Mulholland Drive, every time they'd, drive down that view. Like, to me, that was such an unattainable thing, to be there to see that.
Yeah.
And now I live off Mulholland.
And that's the capital of film noir.
Yeah. And I appreciate it every morning, you know? Last night, I live over by the Mulholland Tennis Club. Last night, I'm driving home, and there was a deer in the middle of the street.
Yeah.
You know?
I've had them walk through my backyard.
Yeah. I love it. You hear owls.
Yeah, we get coyotes walking through the backyard who live at the edge of my yard.
Yeah. So. I was just you can cut this. It's just a dumb behind-the-scenes story, but I have photos to back it up. So this will stun you. I'm big on Halloween. So normally my decorations go up September 1st. Like, I've waited, and my daughter, my youngest daughter is 14. She's said, like, Dad, just wait till the 15th. Just try to hold on till the 15th. So I waited till the 15th, so... And then I got busy and I couldn't do it. So my wife texts me last night. I was out. And she goes, hey, Molly, her friend, Molly and I are going to put up some Halloween decorations. I go, just wait. Just wait. I'll do it tomorrow. I promise. She goes, well, we'll do a couple things. Don't you worry about it. It'll be fine. So I go home and I get out of the car and the garage door is open. And the first thing I look at in the garage is the tubs of Halloween decorations. It's like, oh no, what have they done? They're still there. It's like, okay, great. And then I walk up to the door and I hear, hey, Dana. Hey, Dana. Come over here. And it's my wife. But she's, and I look, my wife and her friend were dressed in skeleton outfits, hiding in the trees in the yard. They're like, you didn't see us driving up. We've been standing here for 20 minutes. Says, I planned this prank for 7 days. It went right in the toilet. But it's nice to know you married the right person.
Yes, because your lack of curiosity.
Yes, exactly. Yes, because I was driving and watching porn on my phone. I couldn't see my wife in the yard in a skeleton suit. No, I'm joking. Yeah. But
nah.
No, but the other thing about I moved to LA and I always wanted to be in show business, and I find the history of it fascinating. And what's always great about making films or television is it's practically impossible to do.
Yeah,
and
increasingly so.
Yes. And you have to learn how to adapt and evolve. Nothing that you see on TV or in the movies, with maybe the exception of Stanley Kubrick's work, is exactly what they set out to make.
Right.
It's always There's always stories. You know,
you're always rolling with punches.
Yeah. The easiest and ultimate example is that on Jaws, the shark didn't work.
Right.
So it became a movie largely about yellow barrels. but it worked, you know, yeah. And it made the movie a better movie. You know, in Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein, they didn't even want Bela Lugosi in the movie.
Oh, my God.
Universal just... I don't know what he did. I mean, he turned down Frankenstein, which they didn't appreciate.
Right.
But
that gave us Boris Karloff.
That gave us Boris Karloff. It was early, and he
good
you know,
trade-off.
And they never. You know, the famous story is you had mentioned Bela Lugosi to Boris Karloff, and his response would always be, "Poor Bela." I know that on Son of Frankenstein, which. Whenever people say Bela Lugosi, now again, ladies, before I go on this rant, let me just say up front, Taken, okay? So don't go driving by my house, because I know a wealth of information about the Son of Frankenstein.
Yes, yeah. I know that's going to just bring
somebody
them all
got
to your
there.
Door.
Somebody
yeah.
got there first.
Yeah.
But whenever people say Bela Lugosi is a sweaty actor, which you hear, like, he's not. He's amazing. Igor in Son of Frankenstein... and Ghost of Frankenstein, steals the show.
Yeah.
He's fantastic.
Broken-necked, hanged yeah. unsuccessfully Igor.
Yeah, he's great. And he got paid for Son of Frankenstein a pittance. And Boris Karloff and Basil Rathbone found out how much he was getting paid and were horrified. And they went to whoever was running Universal at the time. By that time, the Lemleys... had been bought out, and it was a different consortium of business people. And they said halfway through the production, you pay him what we're getting, or we're not going to work. We're not going to work.
Wow.
Yeah, and they just bullied Universal.
Good
into,
for them.
Yeah, and then Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein a couple years later. They didn't even want Bela to do it. They were going to cast an actor named Ian Keith, and I think it was Bela's agent or manager at the time had to go in and go, like, look what... Look at the money he made for you people, you know.
This is Dracula.
Yeah.
The character is Dracula.
Yeah.
You can have the original Dracula.
And he's great in it.
He's great in it.
He's yeah. great in it.
And
yeah.
it's interesting. Glenn Strange took it. Boris Karloff was fairly old when he made the first Frankenstein in 1931 for a guy to be under pounds of makeup.
Yeah.
And so this is like 17 years later. He's certainly not going to want to play the Frankenstein's monster. But Glenn Strange, who'd been on Gunsmoke and, mm-hmm. After that, was, you know, he had done Frankenstein before and done it successfully.
Yeah, he was Frankenstein and all the monster rallies.
The Ghost of and yeah, all of that.
House of.
But he's really good as Frankenstein's monster in this.
He's great. And I had the Aurora model kit is
me too.
More Glenn Strange's image on the cover than Karloff's.
Yeah, that's a Basil Gogos painting.
Of course it is. But I thought as a kid that Glenn Strange's Frankenstein was scarier than Karloff's. Not as fascinating a character. It doesn't have the pathos that right. Karloff has or the sort of the Chaplin-esque stuff. But just in terms of like his look was... I thought as a kid was much scarier than, and I know when Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein, he's a stunt double sometimes. I also think that Lon Chaney Jr. is Frankenstein in one scene.
Really?
Yeah.
I did not know that.
Yeah. I think it's the scene, there is a movie where he is the Wolfman and also Frankenstein. It
right.
might be Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman where he doubles
really?
For Lugosi in one scene.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah, you can look it up, ladies. it's obvious when you look at it. And I think it's Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein in
wow.
the scene where the Wolfman is strapped to the table and Frankenstein tries to and then he spins him around and the Wolfman is spinning around
right,
on the surgical
right,
table.
Right.
I believe that's Lon Chaney Jr. is Frankenstein's monster and a stunt guy.
And
in the
he'd done
suit.
Frankenstein's monster before.
Yeah. 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 Yeah.
But what was your introduction to Abbott and Costello? For me, I think it was actually their TV show before I saw Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein, you know, with mm-hmm. Sid Melton and just their band of players.
Right.
The Abbott and Costello show, which was my introduction to them. I had no idea they'd been vaudeville. They'd been super, super movie stars first. Because that came
They were burlesque comics. I never, you know, as a comedy person, they were only as good to me. They weren't like the Marx Brothers that transcended their material. The Marx Brothers were greater than the sum of their parts.
Right.
And created something that transcended the quality of the script.
And Laurel and Hardy were filled with heart and
sentiment
and just these deep feelings you don't normally get from a comedy, do you?
Yes, agreed. Abbott and Costello, to me, were only as good as their bits. They were only as good as their material. And they were burlesque. You know, the candle on Dracula's coffin in this movie.
Right.
It's a great bit. It's an old burlesque comedian bit.
Right, but they do it well.
They do it great. Yeah. But that's what we would call out of the trunk bit. Like, that's an old, old bit. There's one of their movies, I forget which one, where they just do the Susquehanna Hat Company bit.
Slowly I turn, and they did it again on their TV show.
Yes, hilarious bit. Had nothing to do with the movie that they're talking about.
Right.
It's funny, on Trailers from Hell, John Landis talks about it, and he goes, the movie just stops, and then they do the Susquehanna Hat Company, and then the movie starts again, and he's really true. It's exactly what happens.
But thank goodness
that's really
it's
funny.
There.
Can we get back to the story?
Well, Johnny Grant was their writer, and so I'm sure he had a trunk full of their routines at his beck and call every time.
Yeah, and they were, and you know, look, I mean, Who's on First is like a comedy classic, and it's been rewritten and redone a million times. That's their, you know,
the neo plus ultra. Yeah.
Thank you. Wow, well put. I was going to say they're my generation, but you put me to shame. But you shamed me, Mick. But yeah, it was, this movie was a huge hit at the time, really reinvigorated their career. And I think then they went off on a whole run of Abbott and Costello Meet the Invisible Man, Abbott and Costello Meet the Killer Boris Karloff, Abbott and Costello
Meet
the Mummy.
Each one doing less box office than the one
before. And less funny. This really, like this and Buck Privates are probably their two best films.
I'd agree.
Yeah, I'd agree. Hold That Ghost is also
That's
a remake of a Bob Hope movie, basically.
The Ghost Breakers.
Ghost Breakers.
Yeah.
Hey, no kidding. And neither of them as funny as the Three Stooges: A Haunting, We Will Go.
Well, let's see.
Which has one of my favorite tropes in the Three Stooges. I'm going to name drop, but I'm going to name drop in a way that your audience will appreciate it.
Oh, okay.
I was talking to Sven Gulli, Dave Koz, and he was talking about that when he was not always Sven Gulli, he would also as himself, Rich Koz. Dave Koz is a musician.
There's two of them.
There's a Dave Koz that I know, and I always conflate the two. No, I was talking to Rich Koz, and he was saying we would do theme weeks on the Three Stooges because he hosted the Three Stooges. And I said, like, well, what theme do they have outside of slapping each other?
Yeah.
And he goes, oh, no, there's lots of themes. There's birds crawling into objects and having them fly. I was like, oh, my God, you're right. And that's true. And in Haunting, We Will Go when the bird crawls into the skull and then the skull is flying around. By the way, physiologically not possible. The skull's far too heavy for that bird to get up in the air.
So I have something to share with you.
Oh, I'm very excited.
When I was a kid, I met the Three Stooges.
That's insane.
They came to the local supermarket to do a signing of records. This was around the time of the Three Stooges Meet Hercules.
Right. So it's Curly Joe Derita?
Joe Derita and Mo and Larry.
Right.
And I have a record that they have all signed, Happy Birthday to Mickey. It's a comedy routine, and then they plug in
the name,
singing Happy Birthday to different names. And
wow.
I selected Happy Birthday to Mickey, and they have all signed it.
Wow. Do you know Drew Friedman?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Great, great artist, cartoonist.
He would buy that off you if you
ever wanted to. No, I'm not.
He does. He has a lot. I mean, I have some of his work in my house, but he has his art, for the people unfamiliar with Drew Friedman, he does pointillism.
Yeah, beautiful.
And it's breathtaking. But he does like stunning portraits of Shemp.
Yeah, Shemp at 70.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like really, he doesn't do Napoleon. He does like, you know,
and
Shemp.
They're not flattering portraits.
Yeah, not at all, not at all.
But they're absolutely beautiful. He's got books of his portraits and old Jewish comics.
Old Jewish comics. And the book that really, really helped define my sense of humor. And I didn't see it until I was already a professional comedian when I saw this book. And it really was sort of like getting when you go to the eye doctor and they go like, better or worse, better
right,
or worse,
right.
better or worse. That's also Tinder. it was like getting the right prescription. It was like, no, this is what I think is funny. This is what I think is funny. He and his brother have a book called Any Relation to Persons Living or Dead is Purely Coincidental.
Oh, yeah.
And it's a lot of it's a compendium of their old stuff from like Screw magazine and things like that. But that introduced like Tor Johnson.
Oh, yeah.
As a comedy character to them. Like
Work for Tor.
Work for Tor, Bella Hominy Tor. And just like, yes, old Bela Lugosi getting calls in the middle of the night from Tor Johnson. This is my sense of humor. This is the stuff that I think is funny. And to my great financial detriment, I have not moved off that.
Investing in original Drew Friedman.
Yeah. It's like, art. I'm not going to go out of my way to, I'm going to do a Dr. Zayas talk show. I don't care if not everybody gets it.
What made you a monster kid?
I'm the fifth boy in a family of six.
Wow.
Yeah. And all of my older brothers are athletes and hunters and stuff like that, as is my father. And I just was the runt of the litter and never played sports. I mean, I did play sports, but I was never an athlete and did not want to hunt or anything like that. And just really dug monster movies right out of the gate. I think at the time, a psychiatrist would say it would know better than I would, but monsters are outcasts, and so was I.
Yeah.
I think that's also why I related to Planet of the Apes so much, because he was an outcast. He was in a world that didn't make any sense to him. And that sort of was my child's eye view of my upbringing.
I think that's what binds a lot of genre fans together, you know, and one reason that there are horror conventions and there aren't drama or Western conventions.
Yeah, and it's why everybody at horror, and it's why you never hear of a fight breaking out at a horror convention.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, because we're all the same person.
Yeah.
You know, and they go off into different strains, like Monster Kids. Some of them go off into, a lot of them go off into the business and special effects, or in our case, writing.
Right.
Or they go into metal.
Right.
They go into rock music.
Yeah.
And
something you don't want your parents to embrace.
Exactly. Exactly. But we're all the same, you know. I'm really good friends with Rob Zombie's bassist, who the world knows him as Piggy Demon. I know him as Matt. And we don't look on the surface like two guys that would be friends.
Right,
you know?
Right, yes.
And he's the greatest guy on earth, you know.
Sitting together at Cantor's.
Yeah, exactly. But we do all the time. You know, he's great. And because
as Rob is.
Yeah, we're this, exactly, yeah, because underneath we're the same person.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're the same. We were not cool growing up.
What is it about Abbott and Costello that made them so successful? Because probably more than any other duo in comedy duos in movies, particularly of that era.
Well, there are...
You had Martin and Lewis, of course.
Yeah, Martin and Lewis, I would probably say were not only bigger than Abbott and Costello ever were. I would equate them with the Marx Brothers in the sense that because of Jerry, they were able to transcend their material. And when they broke in the early 50s, like nobody was bigger than they were. But and Bud then, and Lou coming up through music hall and burlesque were just a classic textbook definition comedy team, like Laurel and Hardy, you know, tall, skinny guy, short, squat guy, funny guy, straight guy, although Laurel and Hardy were both a bit, had their own characters.
Right.
And in this case, it was classic, you know, it was basically a ventriloquist act. You know, because
so Bud didn't do much.
Well, but no, but Bud did what ventriloquists always do, which is, now don't say that to these nice people. You know, he's always the scold that is always trying to correct the dummy or Lou Costello, who is a giant 9-year-old.
Right. And what is the weight that the straight man has to carry?
He's got to move it along. I mean, you're a musician. He's the bassist. He's keeping the beat.
Yeah.
And you can't do it without him.
Yeah.
It's amazing that people don't understand that. I've been in situations with bits in film and things where they say, well, can you just cut that part out and go right to the funny part? And I'm like, no.
Then you're a sketch show.
But it's also, it would just be like, no, because of the setup, it doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, it is what it is, but they were huge in the 30s and 40s, you know, especially during World War II. They were so big. And I think a lot of it was Lou Costello was a very, very compelling performer.
Yeah. But the infantilism of his character, you know, the man child, was so popular, you know.
Yeah. And you didn't get that with Hope and Crosby. You didn't get that with. Laurel and Hardy were a little, it was a different kettle.
They were both
of fish.
Childlike.
Yeah. And they were really done. They were kind of done by that time. And it wasn't until Jerry Lewis, you know, and you know, you could say that Lou Costello played a 9-year-old and Jerry Lewis played a 6-year-old. But you know, Jerry Lewis when he peaked, nobody had seen anything like that before.
Yeah.
You know.
And then he became, once he and Dean Martin split up, he became a director as well. Well, he did those great Frank Tashwin movies.
He did, yeah. And I mean, he's a legendary guy. And he, to me, the fascinating story with Dean and Jerry is The Nutty Professor, where Jerry plays Dean and Jerry.
Yes. Yeah.
You know,
it's great. That's my favorite.
Do both.
I remember seeing that in the theater when I was a kid. And just, I could not laugh hard enough during the transformation sequence.
Yeah.
It was so good. And Jerry wrote a book called The Complete Filmmaker.
Yes, he did. He invented the videotape.
Yeah.
But I find just the psychological display of The Nutty Professor, where he decided to be both he and Dean Martin.
That's like, pretty.
I don't need Dean Martin. And then when Dean first left, they tried to find different people to be the new Dean. And one of them was Darren McGavin.
Really?
And the Delicate Delinquent.
Wow. I didn't realize they were trying to create a new team.
Yeah. Well, they were trying out people to see who would be the straight man to Jerry. And Darren McGavin was right in there.
Wow. Well, I'm glad he became the Night Stalker.
Yeah, I am too. Yeah.
Jerry did well on his own.
Witnessing things even more horrifying than Jerry Lewis.
A fascinating guy. I met him once when John Landis was directing a Pepsi commercial for Japan.
Uh-huh.
And so Jerry wouldn't do an American TV commercial, but he did one for Japan.
Oh, I didn't know that John directed Jerry.
Yeah, in that commercial. And it was amazing because by that point in his life, he was a legend.
Sure.
So he was not being the Jerry he was famous for being, which was not the friendliest or nicest or most generous of people. But in this case, everybody was genuflecting to him.
So
he was
placated.
Very nice. And he,
That makes sense. Yeah, he was. Jerry was the opposite of Don Rickles in the sense that Don Rickles played like this, you know, scabrous assassin on stage.
Yes.
But then off stage, Don was lovely. Like he was a delight.
Cat.
Yeah. Jerry was just the opposite. On stage, he was really sweet. And then off stage, he was a tyrant.
Yeah. My parents got married in Las Vegas and they went to a show of Martin and Lewis on their honeymoon night.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Such a small world. John Landis introduced me to Don Rickles
because
John
Mr.
made
Warmth.
The documentary about yeah. him. And we were at a big party, big showbiz party. And I was there and John said, Don, this is a friend of mine, another stand-up comedian, very good, and a friend of mine, and he introduced me, and Don went, what's your name? And I went, Dana Gould, and he goes, I don't care. And then I laughed, and then he goes, and he like put his hand on my knee, and he goes, see, that's my thing. I'm always like taking shots at people. You got to come up with a thing, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, like, no, I'm okay. I got something.
Good advice. Yeah, yeah.
But he can't. Like he was. Bob Goldthwait tells a really funny story. They did an episode of Tales from the Crypt together, I believe. And you know, like they would, and like he was always ragging on Goldthwait on set, like you know, for whatever, just being Don Rickles. And then when they were alone, Don would be like, "Are you taking care of your money? Do you need?" Somebody, you got to take care of your money. Like he was just like your dad. He was just like really sweet. And the only thing about Bob that he really couldn't understand was that he wore jeans on stage.
Oh.
That was the thing that he just couldn't wrap his head around.
You need to remove yourself from the audience?
I don't know what it was. Just like he could, just a different school. Like I'm like that now. Like I see comics on stage in sweats. I'm like, put on a pair of jeans.
Come on, Futterman.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. You know, you always become, you're set in, you know, whatever you did when you were 26 is what everybody is supposed to do. But I found that really interesting. And Lou Costello was one of those personalities, like a purportedly a real piece of work, difficult and kind of a bastard off camera.
What a shame, because... He really fools you.
He
plays the sweetest, most lovable guy in the world on screen.
Yep, yep.
And your heart goes out to him, and, you know, Bud is the bad guy who's always chastising him.
Yeah. And Bud was just the opposite, like a real sweet guy.
Sweet and quiet and, yeah.
Yeah. I'm wondering what Lon Chaney Jr. was like on that set.
I wonder. He was famously a drinker.
Yep. Him and Lou.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you look at these guys, it's like, you know, they're 41, 42 years old, and they're already like, you know, leathered and sweaty.
Jowly.
Yeah. 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 You know, it's funny. You talk about, I mentioned Darren McGavin. I watch The Night Stalker every year. Some people read Lord of the Rings every year. I watch The Night Stalker. It takes less time.
It's 75 minutes.
75 minutes. I can do it during a meal. And we just watched it the other night. We usually watch it to kind of kick off Halloween season. And there's a scene in the police department, and it's Darren McGavin, Simon Oakland, and all these character actors that from the 50s and 60s,
right.
You know, and now it's 1971 and they're all working. But all of them, my wife was like, my God, look at these guys. They look like they had bourbon and a carton of cigarettes for breakfast. Like, these guys are, like, Simon Oakland was probably 42.
Yeah.
And he was just, like, bloated and sweaty and, like, just Marlboros for breakfast. Yeah, all of those guys look like they were 65 years old.
Well, it's amazing how long these careers would go. Like Abbott and Costello, you know, embracing the new medium of television and the Lux Television Hour or whatever that co-hosted before they had their own half-hour sitcom,
right?
Where they had this stable of players, but they just kept going and going, you know, ever Ready Bunny style.
Yeah, and their sitcom was interesting because it was like an anthology but a comedy. It was really interesting. No one's ever done anything like that since, really.
And they played the same people, you know, they were a comedy duo,
and they did not
change at all.
No, and they had a perfect combo, you know, their personalities clicked perfectly, you know, these two opposing forces.
Yeah.
You know, and it's funny, when two people meet, that don't necessarily get along,
right,
as friends, but it just, like, I'm using a musical analogy, but, like, you know, many, Pete Townsend and Roger Daltrey,
yeah,
like, they're not best friends.
They don't hang out together.
They don't hang out at all, but they need each other.
Yeah.
And they know it. Now they're older and they know it.
And they bring out the best in
each other. Yeah. And yeah. I think Mick and Keith probably had a bit of that. I know,
John and Paul.
Yeah. They started out as friends, but yeah, then towards the end, yeah, it's like, we're not hanging out, but they needed each other. It was a professional marriage, and it really, really worked. And that's not always the case.
Yeah. Rarely does a comedy duo split and they have success afterwards. You know, yeah, Dean and Jerry did. But, you know, there was the 30-foot bride of whatever Gap. The Lou Costello movie. Whenever they would try and do things separately, it never rang true. They were incomplete in some way.
Yeah, and Bob Hope and Bing Crosby, I never considered like a classic comedy team, because yeah, Bing was just, he wasn't a straight man, he was just there singing.
Right.
You know? Right. And Bob Hope did the same thing without Bing that he did with him.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the same with Dean and Jerry.
Yeah.
You know, Dean was kind of a straight man, but more the handsome singer.
Yeah, yeah. But in that early time, they, you know, or an even better example than, you know, not everybody knows Dean and Jerry, but everybody knows Duke Mitchell and Sammy Petrillo. That's really the past example.
Yeah. It is so
and
weird.
And now we're back to Bela Lugosi.
Yeah, that's right. They did the movie too. But yeah, those guys, I've never seen such a complete copy.
Alarming.
Exactly like Jerry.
Alarming, yeah. Alarming.
But without the talent.
Yeah, same. Yeah. Yeah, the movie we're referring to, if you haven't seen it, you really need to look it up. If you've never seen a movie called Bela Lugosi Meets a Brooklyn Gorilla, you have to see it, because believe it or not, that is not Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis.
Yes, they're impersonators.
They're impersonators. And the people that made the movie knew that they didn't want their names very big on the poster, because they wanted people to just drive by and assume it was
Dean and Jerry and Bela.
Yeah. And Sammy Petrillo was discovered by Milton Berle. Milton Berle brought Jerry in to meet him. He did a sketch on the Milton Berle show.
Right.
As like Jerry's son or something, like a weird sketch. I don't know the specifics. Drew Friedman would know.
Yes.
Bless his heart. And Jerry thought it was funny. Like, oh my God, this kid is funny. But then when he made a whole movie, like kind of ripping off Jerry, Jerry quite understandably lost his shit. And they tried to buy the movie back. And it was just like, no, this isn't funny anymore. This is you're infringing on my business.
Yes.
And the movie ended up being so inconsequential, it didn't matter.
Well, it was a real independent studio. It wasn't.
Yeah, Poverty Row kind of thing. Yeah, but exactly. It is. I've never seen anything like it in terms of just the shameless.
The blatancy.
Yeah, just talk about like a lack of concern for someone's intellectual property.
Yeah, we're ripping them off and we're proud of it.
Yeah, it would be like if I made Planet of Some Other Apes. It's just, no, it's similar. It's a guy that looks like Charlton Heston Lyons on a planet of apes. They're different apes. It's not the same apes.
They're gorillas instead.
Yeah. Frankensteinish. You can do that.
Well,
yeah, I've never seen anything that nakedly flagrantly steals.
It just completely steals. Yeah. I mean, Sammy Petrillo's career did not last a long time.
No, that was. He's, I mean, he did stuff, but yeah, that was kind of it.
Yeah, that was the hallmark of his career. Yeah.
That was, he had reached the event horizon of his abilities.
But at least he has it to look back on, or had it.
I
imagine he's no longer with us.
But. Yes. No, I think they're all different. What is interesting about, you know, you said Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein really did put a stake in the heart of the Universal Monster
That's what
cycle.
I wanted to get to.
Oh, yeah. Great minds think alike. And sometimes mine.
But yeah, it really put an end to the classic monsters. There'd been the run in the 30s with Frankenstein, Dracula, Werewolf of London. Mm-hmm. And then 1941, it was revived with the Wolfman, and there were all the monster mad parties.
Right, but the first one, it's interesting, the first one ran out of gas because it wasn't censorship, but there was a cultural shift from the business point of view, and I think it was probably I don't know if it was the onset of World War II in Europe, but or if it was a corporate change at Universal, and I used to know this, I'm ashamed of myself, but that went out, the monster cycle went out the window.
People were interested.
Might have been the Hays office.
Yeah, it might be the contemporary stories were becoming more popular than the historical castles. And
yeah, Deanna Durbin ended up being what Universal made money on was a sort of like older Shirley Temple-ish young girl that made a lot of
singer,
and Andy Hardy movies and thus and such.
Well, that was MGM.
MGM, right? Because that was Judy Garland, who then went to make Raging Bull. But they willfully stopped the horror cycle, and then famously, a theater reran Frankenstein and Dracula in like 39 or 40.
Yeah, I think they did a reissue with Real Art.
And it went through the roof, or as others would say, went through the rough. and they said, oh, maybe we should make these again. And then the Wolfman kicked off that sort of second cycle.
Yeah.
And then that ran its course. And Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein, you know, they had run out of stuff to do with it, so they spoofed it.
They took two of their most formerly popular formulations.
Right.
And tried to jam them together.
Right.
In the hopes that.
But then it came back again.
1954.
1954, The Creature from the Black Lagoon, and which is weird. It's a throwback to the older Universal films. But then it was the mid-50s, and you had all the giant bug films.
Well, starting with Godzilla, and
right.
Also 1954, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, and then you also had all It Came from Outer Space,
right?
And
Corman pictures,
right? This Island, was this Island Earth Universal?
That was Universal.
They sort of
that was a big budget sci-fi one. In fact, it I remember the trailer saying 2.5 years in the making, and they treated it like Forbidden Planet. It was
right.
Their Forbidden Planet, big budget, big studio movie, but still a genre film.
Yeah, and that was. It's funny because The Creature from the Black Lagoon, which is so many people's. People dig the creature like no other classic monster.
To Dave Scow about the creature.
But also like other like my business manager's husband, who's like not in the business, writes for the LA Times. But like he loves The Creature from the Black Lagoon.
Well, that design is magnificent.
There's
and the
just
woman who designed
Millicent,
it,
Millicent Patrick.
Yeah, she's just come into fame in the last few years because of the book about her designing that.
Interviewed the woman that wrote that book?
No.
Oh, I know her. She's great.
Yeah. But that design. It was the first memorable design for a monster in many years.
Yeah, probably since the Wolfman.
The Wolfman, yeah.
Yeah. So,
and it's one of the most crucial things about a monster movie with legs is a monster that sticks into your psyche. I mean, the Frankenstein monster, when Jack Pierce designed it, was just what a brilliant design it was. And then in the hands of Bud Westmore, I don't know how much of the work he actually did on Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein, but
he would run in whenever there was someone in the shop with a camera. That's what people would say.
He ran the department, but he didn't necessarily do the work.
No. Yeah. And this one, what's interesting about Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein, I don't know if this was the first time they did it, but some of our many makeup artist friends would probably know, was that these are all makeup. Dracula, Frankenstein, the Wolfman, more Frankenstein and the Wolfman. These are makeups designed by Jack Pierce.
Right.
Jack Pierce, by that time, had been shown the door.
Yeah.
And where he built up the Frankenstein head with, I think it was collodion?
Collodion.
These were foam rubber appliances. The Wolfman's nose, too, was not sculpted putty. It was a foam rubber appliance. And I think
which
it
was a real change.
Huge. It might have been, I don't know if the House Ofs had foam rubber or not. Bill would know, or Greg would know. But, you know, it was the beginning of a new era of monster makeup. And, it, you know, I'm sure it made the actor's life a lot easier.
Yeah, I mean, there were still plenty of people doing it old style. I mean, The Outer Limits still has masks rather than makeups where they're immobile.
Yeah.
They're cool. They're great.
They're cool, yeah. Also, but, speaking of, see, but now you have Dave Scal on the brain.
Yeah, exactly. From The Creature to Outer Limits. Well, he's been on. He's a friend.
Yeah, he's a friend of mine.
Yeah. He's a friend of everybody.
Yeah.
But, the whole idea of monster makeup didn't really even get taken seriously by the Academy until 1981 with American Werewolf.
Right. And that was because there was an outcry because
it the wasn't Elephant a Man, makeup.
Well, no, it was because the year before The Elephant Man did not get anything to recognize its achievement.
They considered it a special effect.
Yeah, or I don't know if they gave it a special award, but that was the thing that tore it. And the Makeup Academy said, we need an Oscar.
Right. And so along came American Werewolf.
Yeah, perfect timing.
Yeah, it was great. But what are your
another movie that is a perfect distillation of comedy and horror.
Right. I mean, but it doesn't play like a comedy. It's funny.
I did a comedy horror series on IFC.
Yeah.
Called Stand Against Evil.
Yeah.
And I stole the John Landis algorithm from An American Werewolf in London. And I'd like to say I stole it quite blatantly.
but like Sammy Petrillo.
Exactly. I was the Sammy Petrillo of. But John nailed it to the wall. Yeah. That's how you do it. And what it was is the monsters are straight as a heart attack and they don't know they're in a comedy. And like in American Werewolf in London and largely in Stand Against Evil, the people don't have to act funny.
Right.
They just have to act normally. They don't act in a stylized horror movie way. They act the way you would act or I would act.
Like Werewolves Within is another one that I think does that combination successfully.
Yeah.
And of course, The Howling.
It's just people behaving normally in the midst of a supernatural effect is all you need. And then there are a litany of people that don't understand it and don't get it right. And the minute the monsters are wacky, to me, it all goes out the window. Now, for every rule, people break it brilliantly. What We Do in the Shadows.
Oh, great.
You know, and I'm just like, I throw up my hands. Like, well, you broke every rule and it's brilliant. So good on
you. Shaun of the Dead is another great one.
Yeah. There's only the scene when the zombie is on the leash and they're throwing records at him. That's really the only scene where the zombies are played for comedic effect.
Right, right.
Other than that, it's pretty straight.
Yeah. That's a great one.
That's a great one, yeah.
But mostly, when I hear the term horror comedy, it makes me want to run the other way. Because so many of them, people think...
They don't know how to do it.
People think spoofing something is comedic. And it's easy to just make fun or mock a scene from a famous horror movie.
Right.
But it's not easy to create a story with wit and surprise and the elements that make a good horror movie and a good comedy, and meld them together, and the way that the best ones do it.
It's funny you said meld because I went to Mel.
Yes, of course.
You know, Young Frankenstein is really
perfect.
It's perfect, and it's. I don't think that move. I think one of the reasons, like Mel Brooks, is a force of nature. And you, and, you know,
he's
and,
a god.
Yeah. And the movie was not his idea. It was Gene Wilder's idea.
Yeah.
But Mel has such a love of the genre that the film works because it is so in love and is so respectful of its source material.
Well, the passion for the source material is so obvious. And I worked with Mel when I wrote The Fly, too.
So you know, yeah.
Just a wonderful guy and so knowledgeable about film history, about the horror genre, particularly the Golden Age.
Right, yeah. And, you know, he went and found Kenneth Strickfaden's old lab set. You know, yeah. And that's why that movie works. And I say, as a comedy writer who's also written straight horror, you can write a really funny sketch set in the world of horror. It's really hard to write a feature that sustains itself. And the famous story on Young Frankenstein is that Mel was dead set against putting on the Ritz.
Really?
Yeah. He thought, this is going to, it's too much.
It's breaking the
law. It's
going to
break the, yeah, it's going to break the story. It's too much. And you know, this is why Mel is Mel. And he goes, I was completely wrong. I'm so grateful that Gene won that fight. Yeah. And
it's a classic sequence.
And it gives that movie what it needs, which is a kick in the act.
Yeah.
A kick in the third act. Boom, it propels it. Because you need something to come in at the end when, like, oh, I know this is funny. Like everybody has their bits. You know, Kenny Mars, he's going to do his bit. You know, and then before it gets to the point where, all right, now there's going to be another thing that I've already seen before. No, then he comes in. Same with a movie that didn't intend to be funny but is hilarious, Plan 9 from Outer Space.
Yes.
Just before you've seen everything, and then Dudley Manlove comes in as Eros, and you get this breath of, like, that movie is inadvertently structured brilliantly for comedy because it never repeats itself. It's terrible in new ways all the way through the
yes.
movie.
Wonderfully terrible. Watchably terrible, which most movies that try to be campy are not.
No, and it, well, it's
it
not trying.
It's trying to be a good movie.
Yeah, it's there's a really brilliant monograph about Plan 9 from Outer Space written by a woman named Catherine Coldiron, who's since I read this, I've had her on my podcast and she's become a friend, and she nails it. She goes, the thing about Plan 9 from Outer Space that is so magical is, for a movie as bad as it is, it thinks it's doing great.
Yes.
You know, exactly. And it really is. And she also called it, it's not so much a movie as a filmed attempt to make a movie.
That says it.
Yeah. But it's really true. Plan 9 from Outer Space and Glenn or Glenda, really both. Like,
astonishing.
The sincerity of it.
Oh, especially Glenn or Glenda.
Yeah, yeah. Just the sheer sincerity of it. Like, this movie wants to be good.
And there are movies that try to be campy. And
yeah.
I don't think any of them work.
No. No, I mean, I love John Waters.
Oh, but, yeah. But that's a different thing.
Yeah, that's a different thing. He knows going in what he's doing.
Yeah, he's being transgressive, yeah. And he's just stretching the boundaries and melodramatic and all of that.
And, well, we were talking earlier, one of the things that I do is we do a live staged reading of Plan 9 from Outer Space every year.
Which I can't wait to see.
Yeah, this year, if you're in the LA area, it's October 10th at Largo. You can get tickets at danagould.com. You can find a link there. You know, it's like watching it if it was done as a radio play. I narrate it and I have funny narration, and then everybody else is just reading exactly what the script is.
Right.
We don't have to make fun of it. It's right there.
The purple prose of Ed Wood.
Yeah, and we have, you know, it's me and Lorraine Newman and Bobcat Goldthwait and Tom Kenny and Janet Varney and Matt Brong and Rob Zabrecki. I mean, we have a really great cast. And I'm leaving people out. And it's October 10th at Largo. And so that was a big hit for me. We do it every year, and we've taken it on the road. And And people have always said, well, you need to find another movie. Just do another bad movie. Easier said than done.
Yeah.
Looked at a lot of bad movies, but very few are bad in the way that is A, consistently funny, and B, consistently funny because of the spoken word, because right. of the dialogue. Like, yeah, Robot Monster's funny to watch.
But it's not good for a reading.
It's not good for a reading.
Yeah. Glenn or Glenda?
Glenn or Glenda, there's not enough dialogue there. But the best description of Glenn or Glenda I've ever heard was Scott Alexander's, who co-wrote the film Ed Wood, who
we
said,
yeah.
it's a different film every 10 minutes. it's really true.
It is true.
We found that I Married a Monster from Outer Space is very good.
That's great.
Yeah, that would be if Plan 9 from Outer Space is The Who, I would put that at The Kinks.
Yeah,
you know, it's similar enough. It doesn't quite reach the heights.
We opened for The Kinks once.
Really?
Yeah.
But yeah, that works really, really well.
It's interesting because that's a good movie.
Yes, it is. Yeah, it is. But it's a lunacy.
It is indeed.
Yeah, the fear of the sexism in that movie is off the chart. Like, Showgirls is not as sexist as that. And Showgirls is another example of a bad movie that it's not in the dialogue. It's in the performances that
right.
you see. And
Noni.
Catherine Coldiron, I'm plugging her book. She wrote a book called Junk Film, Why Bad Movies Are Important. And she does a whole section on Showgirls. And she compares it with Staying Alive. And the thing that those two movies have in common is, with one exception, one character in one movie, every single character in both of those movies is a sociopath. Like, no one behaves the way a normal human being would behave in either of those movies.
For sure.
Yeah. But when I was doing Stand Against Evil, I had always wanted to do a horror comedy. And I had pitched a show that basically, I made the mistake of pitching it to Comedy Central.
Strike one.
Strike one. And it was basically, and this was before the show The Walking Dead.
Yeah.
But it was, and before Zombieland, it was, what if the cast of Seinfeld was in the world of Night of the Living Dead? What if, you know, four jerks were in a zombie apocalypse? And it played like a sitcom with a zombie apocalypse in the background.
Right.
And it was never about, and it was one of my favorite things I've ever written. The pilot episode was this guy, they're foraging for food, and he bumps into his old girlfriend, and he can't believe that they're both alive. But then she thinks that he's stalking her, and so he has to go out of his way to let her know that he's not. But then he sees that she's in danger, and she doesn't see the zombie. So, and it's just like a romantic comedy kind of. And it didn't go, and it's the big Stand Against Evil came about from my desire to still want to do something in the comedy horror genre,
right?
And not being able to do that show, which was called The Last Larry. It was the last guy on earth named Larry. And I'm not inferring that Comedy Central passed on a great show. I'm saying it blatantly.
Fair enough.
Yeah, but all those people are gone that did it. And thank God now we have a network full of game shows and roasts.
Yes.
What I took for Stand Against Evil was, what if Gillian Anderson in The X-Files, instead of being partnered with David Duchovny, what if she was partnered with my dad, who didn't care? It's not that he did or didn't believe.
It's just he didn't give a shit.
Just didn't give a shit. And from that, I built it out into what became Stand Against Evil. And that was all
a very successful horror comedy.
Yes, and that was all the premise it needed.
Yeah.
And But I had to, with the writers, like, say, like, the, with all the meetings of the writers, it was always, the monsters don't know they're in a comedy.
Which is how it should be.
Yeah, the monsters don't know they're in a, and again, I died on that hill, and then What We Do in the Shadows just came and go, no, they can know. You're wrong. and it's brilliant and much more successful than my show was. But for my show to work, that was the rule. And it did work great. And
did you find Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein to be influential in that philosophy?
More than, I no, but American Werewolf in London, for sure. I realized later when I watched Abbott and Costello, I was like, oh, you know what they, because I'd watched it as a kid, and then, you know, you're aware of it. And then I...
Then decades go by.
Decades go by. You discover girls. A couple decades go by. And I was showing it to my children, and they were loving it. And then by that time, I'd already done the show, and I was watching it for the rules. And I was like, oh, yeah, they never... Outside of that one scene where like they're kind of spinning on the table, and it's really not the monster's fault, like, they... play by the rules. And I don't know that director, Charles Barton,
who he did most of the Abbott and Costello movies. He ended up being a utility director,
TV, dozens TV.
From Ironside to Family Affair to you name it.
You know? Family Affair. Hello, Buffy. Hello,
Mr. French.
Originally to be played by Dr. Z, if you know his story.
Yes.
But he either accidentally did it perfectly, or he knew what he was doing.
Or somebody knew what they were doing.
Somebody knew what they were doing, yeah. Because it's tempting to have the Frankenstein monster be funny.
Right.
But you go to Young Frankenstein, like Mel Brooks, you can't teach it.
Right.
You know, you just have to know, you know, and you have to have the right actor and you have to know where the line is. And that's the great thing about comedy. And that's why comedy and horror, they're so similar in terms of the creative process. Like I'm writing a horror movie, and my horror movie, you write it like a comedy movie. What are the big gags?
Right.
All right, now we need to set them up.
Well, you're going for a physical response.
And laughing and screaming are both, and I said this at every pitch meeting for Stan, so this is just like in my head. They're cousins. They are both involuntary reflexes that alleviate tension.
Well, the tension is alleviated by Abbott and Costello when it comes to our favorite monsters. Yeah. And I want to thank you for this celebration of a movie that meant a lot to me. And
we never even got to the opening animation.
The opening animation.
By Walter Lantz, who created Woody Woodpecker.
Right. He was under contract with Universal.
Little gift for the ladies.
Yeah, there you go. Walter Lantz was under contract to Universal, who distributed all the Woody Woodpecker cartoons. And so that's how he became involved in doing the animated title sequence and transformation, Dracula transformation in the movie.
You know what it is? I know where we're going, but one thing about Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein, that it the reason it works like Young Frankenstein, and they're different in terms of their DNA and how they do it. And I don't know if this was intentional in Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein. I know it was in Young Frankenstein. Love of the source material.
Yes.
And that might have just been a studio dictate. I don't know.
Yeah. Follow the rules of our monsters.
Yeah. But you see it in that animation. Like, they loved that world that they had built, and they loved those characters, and
they knew how to build the visual atmosphere.
Yeah, there's no cynicism in it, and you know, you could do a whole you can go into Evil Dead 2. You know, there's so many ways to do this correctly.
Yeah,
and they're all different in how they do it.
Yeah, you know, well, thank goodness for different personalities who create the entertainment we love.
Yeah, I mean, the Evil Dead 2 is just a Three Stooges movie with gore instead of slapstick.
Exactly, splatstick.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Dana Gould, thank you so much. Can't wait to see you in Plan 9.
Yes.
On the stage.
I told you wouldn't have to talk much.
This has been great. It's been great. And we'll do it again soon.
Great. Let's put our pants on.
Okay.
Thank you for listening to Postmortem with Mick Garris. Download new episodes every Wednesday or subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. Postmortem with Mick Garris is produced by Mick Garris and Joe Russo. Our sound engineer is Christopher Leon Price. Our announcer is Jeff Gelb. Our graphic designer is John Holland. And our theme was composed and performed by Bill Burney with additional music by John Jasensky. If you're enjoying our show, please take a moment to rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts.
Thank you for listening to the Dread Podcast Network.